Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Great show for you today. 2 hours of open forum. Second hour, Mark Brumley, president of Ignatius Press, will be here to answer your questions. This hour, Jimmy Akin. And that means you can ask pretty much anything you want. 888-318-7884. 888-318-7884. Anyone is welcome to call, whether you're Catholic or not. As I said, when Jimmy's here, pretty much any question is on the table. You're welcome to bring it. 888-318-7884. Jimmy is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers and the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Senior apologist Jimmy Akin, thanks for being with us.
Host of Catholic Answers Live, Cyril Kellett. Welcome.
What do we got tomorrow?
Tomorrow on Mysterious World, we're going to be looking at the school of Jewish mysticism known as Kabbalah.
Oh, yeah.
Last week, we talked about the secret history of Kabbalah because it claims to be thousands of years old. It claims to go all the way back to Moses on Mount Sinai, but it was kept secret for ages and ages before being disclosed to the public. At least that's what Kabbalists claim. This week, we're going to be looking at what Kabbalists teach. And so we're going to be telling you about the secret teachings that they allegedly kept secret for thousands of years. And wow, are they weird? They are really weird. Yeah.
So this is Kabbalah then is not mainstream Judaism.
Well, it's a little more complex than that.
Oh, okay.
It certainly wasn't mainstream Judaism originally, and it is not accepted by all Jews today, but it has a lot of traction in Jewish communities, especially in the ultra-Orthodox world, in Hasidic Judaism. Hasidic Judaism is a Kabbalistic movement. And so you'll be learning about what they and other Kabbalists believe. And wow.
Okay.
It is something.
I'm looking forward to that, Jimmy. Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World drops every Friday morning. Just type in Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World and you'll find it. The number here again, 888-318-7884. Every single line full already. And so we'll head to New York. Frank in New York listening to EWTN on channel 130. Sirius XM Satellite Radio, you are numero uno today. Frank, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Thank you, gentlemen. God bless you both. First, let me say, Jimmy, I thank you so very much for sending me that book, The Fathers Know Best. It's brilliantly written, and it shows you what the early church really taught. And it's not Protestantism of today. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Glad you're enjoying it.
Yes, I would recommend it to anyone. My question involves, Jimmy, I came up with a theory that says that the pre-tribulation rapture cannot possibly work because if we hold to that, all a man would have to do would be count whether they use the lunar calendar, 360 days a year, or 365 days a year with the solar calendar, count 7 years. And with a little bit of math, he'd be able to calculate the exact second coming of Christ to the exact day. And Jesus said that can't be done. So I just wanted to bounce that off you guys. What do you think of that?
Well, so I think that that there are a few things to be concerned. There are a few things that I could say in response to that. One of them is that people who advocate a pre-tribulation rapture, and I should explain that term for people who may not be familiar with it. This is an idea that got started in the 19th century, and it became popular in some, but not all, segments of Protestantism. The basic idea is that there will be a future thousand-year period where Jesus reigns on earth from Jerusalem. And before that thousand-year period, there will be a shorter window of time, typically said to be 7 years long, in which the Antichrist will reign on earth. And then right before, and that's called the tribulation, and then right before that period, Jesus will return and snatch away all of the living Christians, as well as the deceased Christians and take them to heaven with him so that they don't have to experience the tribulation. That's why it's called the pre-tribulation rapture, because this rapture or catching away of Christians occurs before the tribulation, and then at the end of the tribulation, Jesus will come back and destroy the Antichrist and then set up his earthly kingdom for 1,000 years. And the Catholic Church does not teach this, and historically, most Protestants have not either. This is a phenomenon this is an idea that's believed in only certain segments of Protestantism. So advocates of the rapture would say that what Jesus is saying is impossible to predict is his coming for the rapture, and that could happen at any time, and so that is genuinely unpredictable. But then once that happens, it would be possible to at least estimate how long it will be before Jesus returns again in order to destroy the Antichrist and set up his earthly kingdom. So I think that that's an argument that that a pre-tribulational rapturist could make against this. I would go a step further and say that, and this is an opinion that not everybody shares, but it happens to be mine. If you look at Mark chapter 13, where we have Jesus' statement about no man knows the day or the hour, the context in which he's discussing it is not the second coming. If you look at the beginning of Mark 13, Jesus has just predicted the destruction of the Jewish temple, and then he crosses the Mount of Olives with the disciples, and they say, okay, tell us more about this. Tell us more about the destruction of the temple and what's going to be the sign that it's going to happen and so forth. And Jesus gives a big, long speech, which all deals with the destruction of the temple in the first century. And so, to my mind, exegetically, what Jesus is saying there is not that it's impossible to predict the second coming, but that it's impossible to predict the day on which the temple will be destroyed. Now, I think it's also true that it's impossible to predict when the second coming is going to happen. There's been a spectacular record of failure in people trying to predict that. So I don't think you can predict the second coming either, but I don't think that's actually what Jesus is saying in this passage. And so I would tend to argue against the pre-tribulational rapture on other grounds. The passage where Paul does discuss a rapture-like event is 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. And if you read 1 and 2 Thessalonians and you carefully track what Paul says about Jesus's coming, it's clear that this is not a rapture that occurs before a tribulation that occurs more than 1,000 years before the end of the world. It's something that occurs right at the end of the world.
Frank, it's time for us to take our first break. So I'll say thank you very much for that question. Lots more folks on the line ready to ask Jimmy questions. So we'll continue with Open Forum with Jimmy Akin right after this.
We're here for you. Call now. Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
EWTN Global Catholic Network is the largest religious media network in the world. 11 global TV channels, English and Spanish radio networks with over 500 AM and FM radio affiliates, one of the largest Catholic websites in the world, dozens of podcasts every week, social media, electronic and print news services, and EWTN publishing. EWTN is the global Catholic network. For more about EWTN, visit EWTN.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Keller, your host. Jimmy Akin is our guest. Lots of folks are on the line with questions because it's open forum this hour. You're welcome to call 888-318-7884. Before I go back to calls, I do want to remind you that we're getting closer to the Catholic Answers Conference. It's the last weekend of September each year, and this is our 8th annual Apologetics Conference. It's titled The Eucharist, I Am With You Always. a fantastic lineup of speakers. We're going to do the radio show a couple times. There's all kinds of opportunities for socializing and for spiritual growth. We'll have Eucharistic adoration, confessions, masses, and still a great deal on the hotel rooms, just $169 a night at the Hyatt in La Jolla. So you can find out all about it and make your reservations when you're ready to come. CatholicAnswersConference.com. All right, we go now to Ivan in Orange County, California, listening on Catholic.com. Ivan, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, Jimmy. What is your position on the view that early Christian spiritual experiences like the Transfiguration were not genuine spiritual experiences, but rather the result of abusive psychedelic drugs like the Oracle of Delphi, and what evidence do you have to support your position? Thank you.
Okay, so that went by a little fast, but the basic question was, what would I say about the idea that early Christian mystical experiences like the Transfiguration were not genuinely mystical, but were caused by the ingestion of psychedelic substances like the Oracle at Delphi? Okay, well, so the idea that the Oracle at Delphi allegedly was under the influence of a kind of gas. The Oracle at Delphi, the Oracle at Delphi was a kind of prophetess who spoke for the god Apollo. And she, at least when she was doing her professional work, she would be in a cave, she would sit on a tripod, and some of our early sources indicated there was a kind of vapor or smoke or gas that came up from like a crack in the ground that that may have had a psychogenic effect on her and enabled her to have messages from the god Apollo that she would then announce to people. Well, okay, in the sources that speak about this, well, they talk about that. They talk about the gas or the vapor or whatever it was. Now, there's a debate among scholars about, is that part of the story real? And if it was real, that there was a kind of vapor, did the vapor actually have an effect on her, or could it have been something else? Well, in any event, they talk about it. So we have a basis in the Greek sources for saying that the experiences of the Oracle at Delphi may have been connected with this vapor that the sources describe. But when we look at the New Testament and we look at the – now, when we look at the New Testament, we do not have anything parallel to that. The only substances that are mentioned that Christians ingest are the – that are associated with the Christian faith are the elements of the Eucharist, which Jesus declares to be his body and blood. And those were – if you don't believe that they're Jesus's body and blood, well, then they're just bread and wine. And yeah, okay, wine is a little psychoactive if you drink enough of it, but Christians weren't getting plastered at the Last Supper. In fact, Paul, or later celebrations of the Eucharist, in fact, Paul in 1 Corinthians rebukes some Corinthians who actually were getting drunk at a church feast. So you weren't supposed to be getting drunk in church, and thus you wouldn't be imbibing enough wine to have a notable psychogenic effect on you. Also, wine is not a hallucinogen. Even when people get drunk, they don't typically have mystical experiences. So we don't have a basis there. When we have other passages that talk about mystical experiences, including the Transfiguration, the disciples are not ingesting anything. It mentions in the account of the Transfiguration that they were on a mountain and there was a cloud that descended, but that's a known natural phenomenon. You know, some mountains are high enough that clouds will, you know, come down on them. I've been on mountains like that myself. So they were just on a high mountain and a cloud showed up, but clouds are not psychoactive. So I don't see a basis in the text there. There was one scholar, his name was John Allegro, back in the 1970s, who published a book called The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross, in which he proposed that Christians were ingesting basically a kind of magic mushroom. But his book has been widely regarded by biblical scholars and historians as nonsense. We just do not have evidence for this. And so if we take the evidence of the New Testament texts themselves and just read them in a straightforward way, they do not indicate that the disciples were ingesting any kind of psychoactive substance that would be responsible for the mystical experiences they had. They present them as mystical experiences, and they don't show Christians doing things like taking mushrooms or potions or things like that in order to induce them.
Ivan, thanks very much for that question. That would be a perfect question for when we do Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin. And if you anybody's got a weird question, you can always send them to us at radio@catholic.com. We collect them up and usually do a couple hours with Jimmy of weird questions. Going now to Cincinnati, Ohio, Ethan in Cincinnati watching on YouTube. You are up next, Ethan. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, God bless Jimmy Akin and Cy Kellogg.
Thank you, Ethan.
My question for you is something I was talking about with a Muslim. And they were saying, they were basically saying, okay, if the Holy Spirit's called the Spirit of Truth and it will lead people into all truths and all this kind of stuff, doesn't that imply that there are some truths that the Holy Spirit has that the Father and the Son don't have? Because otherwise, why would it be necessary to send the Holy Spirit? And also, why does the Holy Spirit give certain gifts like wisdom, understanding, counsel, and fortitude and all that kind of stuff? But does the Father and the Son also?
So the Christian understanding is that in every act that God does outside of the Godhead, so everything that God does in the world, is something that all three persons cooperate in, but they don't all do the same thing. So, for example, in the case of redemption, of our salvation, God the Father sends the Son, and the Son dies on the cross for us to provide the grace we need, and then the Holy Spirit applies that grace to us. So all three persons have a role that they play in salvation, but it's not the same role. They each do different things. In the case of information that the Holy Spirit imparts, no, the Holy Spirit does not have information that the Father and the Son don't. On the Christian view, they are all God, and so they are all omniscient, and they each know all truth. And this is, in fact, something that is stressed by St. Paul in his letters to the Corinthians, where he talks about the Spirit of God knows the deep things of God. He knows all God's secrets because he is God. So the Holy Spirit has the same information via omniscience that the Father and the Son do, but God chose to have the Holy Spirit play a role in strengthening the church, in understanding the revelation that Christ had given it. And this is in a way similar to the way prophets work. You know, Muslims will acknowledge that God has sent various prophets over the course of time, and it is certainly not the case that a prophet has information that God doesn't. You know, the prophets have information from God, but God certainly knows what the prophet is going to reveal. And not all prophets reveal the same information. Some prophets say one thing, other prophets reveal something else, so they each reveal a part of what God has chosen to tell us, but they don't all say the same thing. And so even a Muslim should be able to conceptually understand. He may not like it, or he may refuse to believe it, but he should be able, in principle, to acknowledge that the sending of the Holy Spirit to lead us into truth is analogous to God sending a prophet, where the prophet has a certain message that he's going to deliver. God knows what the message is. God sent the person to deliver the message, sent the prophet to deliver the message. In the same way, God knows what the Holy Spirit is going to do with the church, and he sent the Holy Spirit to do it. But that's a general sketch of how I would approach that question. There may have been an auxiliary question you asked. I wanted to make sure, was there an additional part of what you said, or did I cover it all?
Oh yeah, about like for example, like the Holy Spirit gives the gifts of the wisdom, understanding, counsel, fortitude. You know what I mean? Does the Father and Son do that as well? Because it seems like in these conversations, like, you know, we have to make sure it's one will, one power, and all this kind of stuff. And if it seems like we're attributing solely one thing to one person, it seems like it has more more importance or more power or anything than the others.
The same principle that I started with applies to the giving of spiritual gifts. All three persons of the Trinity play a role because this is an action. The giving of spiritual gifts is an act that occurs in the world, and therefore all three persons of the Trinity will play a role in it, but they will play different roles. And the Spirit plays sort of the most direct role in granting these gifts to us.
Ethan, thanks. Lines are full, so I'm going to keep going, but I appreciate the questions. It's open forum today. Jimmy Akin is our guest, and now we go to Denver. Paul, listening on the Alexa in Denver. Glad to have you, Paul. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, thanks. God bless you both. Jimmy, I have this question. I've been trying to look over all your mysterious episodes, and I couldn't find my answer to this question. It's a weird question. It's a question regarding the pentacle with the five-pointed star with a circle around it. I understand historically it started around with the Pythagoreans, if I pronounce that right, and then evolved over the centuries into Baha'i, Mormonism, and things like that. So why does the Catholic Church frown upon the pentacle or any Catholic or Christian wearing a pentacle?
Okay, so you're definitely correct that a pentacle is a five-pointed star inside of a circle. But the historical evidence that I'm aware of would not indicate that it goes all the way back to the Pythagoreans. The Pythagoreans were a school of Greek philosophy in the centuries before Christ. And while they were very interested in mathematics and geometry, I'm not aware of any evidence linking the pentacle to them. The evidence that I am aware of, also I'm not aware of Mormons using pentacles, and I think you may have said Baha'is. I don't know whether Baha'is do or not, but Mormons, as far as I'm aware, do not. The evidence I am aware of indicates that the pentacle began to be used in the 1500s. It first appears in certain grimoires, which are kind of magical texts, like the Heptameron and the Key of Solomon. And so it was from its introduction associated with unapproved magical practices, and that would lead it to be something that people would tend to want to distance themselves from because it was associated with unapproved magical stuff. And then subsequently and more recently, it's also been used in the 20th century by the Wiccan movement. It's also been used by Aleister Crowley's Thelema movement, which is another kind of occult sect that was founded by Aleister Crowley. But that would be why Catholics would tend to distance themselves from it. There's nothing wrong with the shape itself. It's just a five-pointed star in a circle, but it is associated with unchristian things like magic and Wicca and Thelema and so forth. And so for a Christian to go around wearing a pentacle would send the wrong message. It would send the idea that I believe in and approve of these non-Christian things when in fact you're a Christian. And that would be a mixed message that would mislead people.
Paul, I will thank you for that question and for searching diligently Jimmy Akin's mysterious world for an answer and then coming to us here. You're always welcome here, Paul. I'm going to try to get as many as I can on with Jimmy this hour because lots of calls, of course. Let's go to Johnny in Pennsylvania, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Johnny, are you there with us?
Yes.
Hello, Johnny. Hello. How old are you?
I'm 8 years old.
Well, we're happy to have you here. Go ahead with your question for Mr. Akin.
So I was just wondering, why do things physically have to grow?
Okay. Well, they have to grow because we're talking, I assume, here about life forms like plants and animals. And the reason they have to grow is because their genes make them grow. Inside of our cells, we have a chemical that is known as DNA. And what DNA does is it carries the instructions for how to make our bodies. And all life forms have DNA, at least all life forms here on Earth, whether it's a plant or an animal or a human being. We have DNA in our cells that has the instructions for how to make us. But there's more to say about that, and I'll say it on the other side of the break.
Johnny, can you just hang on for a couple minutes?
Yes.
Okay, good. I'm glad you can. We'll be right back for Jimmy to finish his answer for you about why things grow. More Open Forum right after this.
Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you. Have you enrolled in the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics? Let me ask you a more important question. Do you believe as a Catholic that you have an obligation to share the Catholic faith? In fact, the Church has answered this question, and the answer is that all confirmed Catholics are obliged to share the faith. It's actually in canon law. Catholic Answers is here to help you fulfill that obligation. Our School of Apologetics courses will equip you to help all the people you come in contact with understand what the Church teaches and why. A great place to start is with all the Catholics in your life. Learn the art of apologetics from the best of the best and start sharing the gospel today. Visit schoolofapologetics.com. That's schoolofapologetics.com.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
Which of the four Gospels can you best relate to?
You can answer that question tomorrow on Take Two with Jerry and Debbie.
On most of these EWTN stations.
Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
Johnny, 8 years old, on the line in Pennsylvania, got a little bit of groovy music in the middle of his answer. Johnny called to ask Jimmy why living things have to grow. Johnny, thanks for hanging around. Here's the rest of Mr. Aiken's answer.
Yeah, so we have this chemical in each one of the cells that our body is made out of, and the chemical DNA contains the instructions for how to make us. So in my cells, I have DNA that has instructions for how to make Jimmy Aiken. And in Johnny, in your cells, in your body, you have DNA that has instructions for how to make Johnny. And if you have a carrot, the carrot cells have DNA that it has instructions for how to make a carrot. If you have a dog, the dog has instructions for how to make that dog. And this is common to all life forms. But in order for a kind of life form to not just die out, it needs to develop to the point that it can reproduce itself. So like, you know, Johnny, when you're older, you can get married and then you can have your own children and your line of the family will keep going. If you have a dog, the dog, you know, needs to make puppies. And so the dog needs to get old enough and become big enough and mature enough that it can have puppies. Carrots, similarly, they're plants, but they also need to reproduce. And so the DNA in all of our cells causes our bodies, this is just part of the instructions, it causes our bodies to grow and develop over time so that, among other things, we can reproduce our kind and keep our species going. And that's why things grow, because they need to get to that point where they're big enough and developed enough that they can reproduce and give birth to a new generation.
Okay, Johnny?
I'm sorry, but I feel like I asked the wrong type of question. Do they grow, not why do they have to?
Misinterpreted it,
so,
Johnny.
So why do they grow? I wondered if that might be what you were wondering. So in terms of the mechanics of why do they grow, it again goes back to the DNA. Now every cell in our bodies has internal. They're like little organs. They're called organelles, which just means like little organs. And and they have chemical processes that are happening in the cell. We refer to that as metabolism, where it takes in nutrients. So each cell eats, in essence. It has nutrients that it takes in. In the case of humans, it gets those nutrients from our bloodstream. But it takes in oxygen, and it takes in proteins and fats and things like that, glucose, which is kind of sugar. Actually, it all tends to get turned into glucose. But our cells take in these nutrients and they build them up. And then what they do is at a certain point, the DNA has instructions for once you've got enough nutrients, split in half. And that splitting in half is a process called mitosis. And what will happen is a cell will split in half and each of the resulting halves is identical to the original cell. And so when you have, a human baby starts as just a single cell in its mother's body. But then that cell splits and becomes two cells, and then they split and become four cells, and they split and become eight cells, and so on, until they eventually become the trillions of cells that are in an adult human body. And so the actual process of how they grow is by this process of cell splitting, where essentially the cell clones itself. It makes a copy of itself, and that process is known as mitosis.
Johnny, you did a fantastic job, and I'm glad we got you the answer you were looking for. You're always welcome here. Call back whenever you like. And I am going to just keep going, though, Johnny, because I got every other line full. So on we go. Cyrus in Virginia Beach, Virginia, watching on Twitch. Hi, Cyrus. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi. I watched your episode on Exodus, and I saw how you tried to elaborate on how the seven plagues of Egypt could be explained by natural phenomenon. And I was wondering why we don't apply some of the same reasoning to the Marian apparitions. When I watched your episode, I came away with the understanding God can work through his creation naturally to manifest his will. When I see a lot of Marian apparitions, I feel like I have the opposite conclusion, that because it's so unnatural, it is now a candidate for being a miracle. So that's something I struggled with. Wasn't sure if you had anything to say about that.
Yeah, so God can work through his creation in a way that he uses a natural phenomenon to accomplish an effect, but he arranges for it providentially to happen at a certain time. And so from the perspective of faith, we can say, oh, wow, this happened just now. God must have caused that. That's a miracle. It's not the same kind of miracle, though, where God interrupts or supplements the ordinary functioning of nature, like Jesus's resurrection from the dead. That's a different kind of miracle that's even more amazing. So in the case of the Exodus, if God used the natural agricultural cycle in Egypt to produce the 10 plagues, which is something I talked about in an episode of Mysterious World on the Exodus, it could be that God just used really intense weather to cause the 10 plagues to occur at the time they needed to occur in order for Pharaoh to let the Israelites go. So that would have been what you could call a type one miracle, where God uses things in nature that do ordinarily occur, but he arranges for them to occur just when they're needed to produce some effect. On the other hand, people do not, after 3 days, rise from the dead. So that would be a different type of miracle that's even more amazing. You could call Jesus's resurrection a type two miracle. So what do we find when we look at Marian apparitions? Well, in some cases, there may be a miracle of either type one or type two. In the case of Fatima, for example, Fatima is famous for the miracle of the sun, where people in Portugal seem to see the sun dance or spin in the sky. And there have been attempts. I talk about this in episode 40 of Mysterious World. You can get to it by going to mysterious.fm/40, the number 40. There have been people like Father Stanley Yockey who have proposed a kind of atmospheric phenomenon that does occur in nature, that God could have had providentially occur right then to explain at least part of what people saw when they witnessed the miracle of the sun. So there are situations with Marian apparitions where you might encounter what we could call type one miracles of God working through nature rather than supplementing or overriding nature.
Cyrus, all make sense?
Oh, yeah. Thank you very much. Thank God you. Bless. I'm halfway through your episode on Akita. Very good so far.
Thank you.
And by the way, that's an episode on at Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. So that if folks want that, they can go to Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World and find the Akita episode. I'm going to go. Thank you again, Cyrus. Let's go to Aaron in Hastings, Michigan, watching on YouTube. Hi, Aaron.
Hi. I know I've asked this question before, mm-hmm. But I still cannot grasp it. I don't know why.
Well, let's have another go at it then.
How is it that Catholics can believe in the three main theories, like the one that's in the Bible, the 7 days of creation, evolution, and the Big Bang? Because from my understanding of evolution and the Big Bang, they take away God.
Okay. Well, that's not the Catholic understanding. The Catholic understanding would be that God caused the Big Bang, and that he then caused the development of life forms through evolution. So the Catholic understanding would be that God caused the creation of the universe, and then he caused the universe to unfold in a certain way that led to the development of life forms and eventually human beings. And so there are people who want to cut God out of the picture and say there is no God, but that is not something that's intrinsic. It's not part and parcel of either the Big Bang or evolution. In fact, the gentleman who is credited with coming up with the Big Bang theory was a Catholic priest. He was from Belgium. His name was Father Georges Lemaître. And he was a priest and an astronomer, and he looked at the evidence from astronomy and said, you know, it looks like the universe had a beginning where everything was originally compressed into a single point and then it expanded. But he regarded that as something that God did, and subsequent Catholics have as well. In terms of the 7 days, there are different ways that people have sought to harmonize the 7 days with the findings of science. The way that the Catholic Church views them in the Catechism is to say that they symbolically represent the work of the Creator as a succession of 6 days followed by a seventh day of rest. So the Catechism says God really did do all this stuff. He really did make the sun. He really did make the land. He really did make the day and the night. But these have been – these things that God really did do have been symbolically presented as if they occurred in the space of a Hebrew week, you know, just a seven-day period. And there are indications in the text that it's meant to be understood symbolically because God sets up the day-night cycle on day one. Well, the ancients knew just as well as we do that it's the light that comes from the sun that makes it day. And yet in Genesis 1, the sun isn't created until day 4. And so you have ancient authors like, for example, St. Augustine saying these must not be regular days. They must be something other than regular days because you couldn't have a day-night cycle without the sun on the first 3 days. So they must be something else. And the way the Catholic Church today looks at them is that they are a symbol that conveys the essence of what God did, but it compresses it into the framework of a Hebrew week.
Aaron, okay. Go ahead, Aaron. Go ahead.
And I was also wondering, where can I find that at in the Catechism?
It's in the section, it's in part one, which is the section on the creation of, tell you what, we're going to need to take a break. I'll come back and have the exact paragraph number for you.
Hang on, Aaron. We'll do that break. Be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Hello, this is Archbishop Salvatore Cordiglione of San Francisco. Keep your dial tuned to Catholic Answers Live.
You've heard that St. Paul Street Evangelization supports hundreds of teams of evangelists sharing the good news. But did you know that some of these teams are public prayer stations? Set up a sign on the sidewalk and offer prayer and encouragement to those you encounter. Everyone needs prayer. Try this new method of witnessing to Jesus. Contact St. Paul Street Evangelization to get started at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
The most original and exclusive Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
One time somebody said to me, why don't you air these people? And I said, no, because I don't think they're Catholic. He says, by what right do you have to say that? I said, I own the network.
Mother Angelica Live Classics, every morning, 2 Eastern, on EWTN Radio.
On the line in Hastings, Michigan, watching on YouTube with a question about creation and how Catholics can reconcile the biblical accounts of creation and the current scientific accounts. And Jimmy, you wanted to get, he asked for a particular passage in the Catechism.
Yeah. The one that deals with the, and I had the two numbers in my head, but I wasn't sure which went with which passage. There are two passages in the Catechism that kind of cover this from different angles. Paragraph 337 in the Catechism talks about the 7 days of creation. And I was giving a near quotation of it before about a succession of 6 days. It talks about them being symbolic. The other paragraph that you want to look at is paragraph 283. And that one expresses appreciation for the work that scientists have done in investigating the age and dimensions of the cosmos and the emergence of life forms. So they don't use the words Big Bang and the words evolution, but that's what they're talking about. The age and dimensions of the cosmos refers to astronomical discoveries, including the Big Bang, which, you know, occurred around 13.8 billion years ago. So that tells us the age of the universe. And then the emergence of life forms is another way of saying evolution.
Aaron, thanks. You did give me a chance to pitch our podcast, Catholic Answers Focus, so I'm going to do that real quick. If this is something that you'd like to hear more about, Dr. Karin Oberg, an astrophysicist at Harvard who also teaches Aquinas, she did a program with us one time, Does the Big Bang Prove God? You'll actually be surprised by her answer, I think, but it's very insightful from the position of a scientist at Harvard and a Catholic woman. So you can get that just by going to – just you know what? If you just put in Catholic Answers, Karin Oberg, it's the first thing that comes up, at least in my search engine. So Catholic Answers, Karin Oberg, and you'll, it does the Big Bang prove God. Going to Ottawa, Canada now. Daniel in Ottawa, Canada, watching on YouTube. You are up next, Daniel. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, Jimmy and Cy. I really appreciate your show.
Thank you, Daniel.
So I just had a had a quick question about fasting. I've been using it for health reasons. It's been going well.
But
I've been trying to figure out how it fits into my faith life. So I've been reading some Thomas Aquinas, and he said, you know, fasting can help against gluttony. Totally agree with that. That's helpful. But the thing that I have more issues with is how it fits in with my prayer life, because I find when I fast, it's actually harder to pray. You know, I'm either distracted by hunger pangs, or I'm it seems to make it more difficult to pray. So I just wanted to hear your thoughts about that, Jimmy, since I know you you have some experience with that. So
based on what you're telling me, I'm guessing that you don't fast all the time. Like, you don't do a one meal a day every day. You kind of have shorter periods, or you have periods of fasting, but they're not constant. Is that correct?
Well, I'm just starting up, and I'm doing intermittent fasting. And I did a 2-day fast at one point. It was stressful, kind of difficult on the body, but it's effective. So
here's what I can tell you. When you encounter those difficulties, it has, and you have, say, hunger, and you're trying to pray, and the hunger is a distraction. Well, it has spiritual value to push through in those situations, to just do your best to keep praying and not focus on the hunger. And that has spiritual value in itself, because you're persevering in a spiritual practice, even though it's more difficult than it would otherwise be, because you've got this hunger. So that itself adds a spiritual dimension to it, that sort of intensifies the effect of the prayer. On the other hand, this will not happen if you persist in a particular regimen of fasting. That will not keep happening. So monks historically have fasted on one meal a day, and then on Sundays they would have two meals, and on like holy days they would have two meals, and they're not hungry every day, because it turns out that hunger is almost all habit. Your body will make you hungry when you are used to eating, because it figures, oh, it's this time of day, that's when food is available, we better turn on the hunger signal so he'll remember to eat now while the food is still available. And so that's why we get hungry at certain times of day. It's because that's when we're used to eating. And so if you set a different eating regimen for yourself, you simply won't be hungry at other times of day, once your body gets used to the current eating regimen. And so, like, I eat one meal a day in the evenings, and as a result, I'm not hungry all day. I get hungry when it's time to eat. I may experience just a little bit of hunger for like 20 minutes in the day, as my body has finished digesting last night's meal and now it's switching over into burning fat. But really, hunger is a matter of habit. And once you retrain your body to a new eating regimen, you'll only get hungry, or you'll only get significantly hungry at the times when you now are eating. So if you shift your fasting schedule around, or if you don't do it all the time, you may have some hunger, but that is, that itself will add to the spiritual, quality in a way of, or the spiritual punch of your prayer, because by continuing to pray and ignoring the hunger, that has spiritual value. On the other hand, if you set an eating plan and you stick to it, within a few days or a week or two at the most, your body will be used to the new eating plan and you won't be experiencing significant hunger except at the times when you normally eat.
Daniel, going to leave it there. I hope that was helpful to you. Still lots of folks on the line. It's open forum. Jimmy Akin is our guest. So come right back here to California. Ryan in California watching on YouTube. Go ahead, Ryan, with your question for Jimmy.
Hello. So my question is, so it's traditionally held that Jesus died on a Friday. My question is in part, why do we then celebrate Easter on a Sunday when if you were to count up 3 days from that Friday, it would lead you to Monday? And then also, as another part to that question, why do we refer to it as Easter? Because I've heard from some people that Easter is named after a pagan god. So why do we refer it to that instead of Resurrection Day?
Okay. In regard to the first question, in the ancient world, they frequently counted wholes for parts. They had a different way of counting than we do. So the 3 days that Christ are in the tomb are the part of Friday after he died on the cross, all of Saturday, and then the part of Sunday before the empty tomb was found. So those are the 3 days. It's part of Friday, all of Saturday, and part of Sunday. But in the ancient world, that was, since you've got a day and parts of two other days, they counted that as 3 days. It was a different way of counting than we use. And so the New Testament indicates very clearly, it's not just tradition, it's actually in the Gospels. In fact, all four of the Gospels indicate that Jesus was crucified on what was called the Day of Preparation. The Day of Preparation was the day you did all your business so that you could rest on the Sabbath. So the Sabbath is Saturday. The Day of Preparation was Friday. All four of the Gospels say Jesus was crucified on Friday. Also, all four of the Gospels say that Jesus rose from the dead on the first day of the week or Sunday. So that tells us how we need to count all of this. It's in accord with the ancient practice of counting parts for wholes. In terms of why we call it Easter, well, that's just the way English grew up. In other languages, it is not called Easter. Now, there is one and only one early source that suggests that Easter is named after a pagan goddess called Eostre. That one source is the Venerable Bede, who is an English historian in like the 800s. And he says that 200 years before his time, there was this goddess called that pagans worshiped called Eostre. But nobody worshiped her in his time. And he's the only source that refers to this goddess. And he's not talking about his own time. He's talking about centuries earlier. So he may just be wrong about that. The evidence that Easter comes from a pagan goddess is actually quite weak. But that's just English. In other languages, the name for Easter is based on the Hebrew word Pesach, which is the Hebrew word for Passover, because that's when Jesus died and rose from the dead. It was at Passover. And so the name for Easter in other languages tends to be Pasche or Pasch or Pesage or things like that, which are all based on the word for Passover. English is just weird, and that's just how the language grew up.
And how does that sit with you, Ryan?
That's perfect. Thank you.
All right. It did sound perfect, didn't it? Thank you very, very much. Jimmy, I think I'll just encourage folks to hang on. If you've got more, there are more folks with questions. There's one line open right now, and Mark Brumley will be here the next hour. So give a call if you'd like to get in the queue, 888-318-7884. I want to tell us again, we've got a few seconds for you, if you want to tell us again what's on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World tomorrow.
Well, we're going to be talking about the secret teachings of the school of Jewish mysticism known as Kabbalah. And they're not secret these days, but they allegedly were secret for a long time, and they are really strange. They have some really weird ideas about God and the afterlife and the origin of evil, and it should be very eye-opening for people.
And this is the same one that you hear celebrities like I remember Madonna
was, Ariana Grande, yeah.
Oh, Ariana Grande's what's a practitioner of Kabbalah called?
Well, in Hebrew they're called a mukabbalah, but in English we would say a Kabbalist.
Ah, yeah. All right, Jimmy, thanks very, very much.
My pleasure.
As I said, Mark Brumley, president of Ignatius Press, will be here in just a few minutes. So if you're on the line, hang on the line. If you haven't dialed yet, we do have a couple of lines open for you. 888-318-7884. We'll continue with open forum, so you're welcome to ask any question you want of Mark Brumley right after this on Catholic Answers Live.